more than 4,000 graduate students in over 80 different programs of study.
You guys are sort of all over the world, it seems like.
It's kind of mind-blowing when you think about it.
Here on Inspiration Dissemination.
Photographs of this data set stretching over a much longer period of time.
They're now converted into basically mathematical shapes, and we can now analyze the statistics of this shape.
Good evening, listeners.
Good evening, listeners.
Good evening, listeners. It is November 24th, a Sunday, and you're tuned into 88.7 KBVR Corvallis. It is currently just after 7 p.m., and on a Sunday, that can only mean one thing. It's time for another episode of Inspiration Dissemination. I'm Lisa Hildebrand.
And I'm Heather Forsyth. Here at Oregon State, we have more than 4,000 graduate students in over 80 different programs of study. And here on Inspiration, every week, we feature the research and their personal stories. If you're a graduate student at OSU and you're interested in coming on the show, or you just want to find out more about all the awesome things going on at Oregon State, you can check out our blog at blogs.oregonstate.edu/inspiration. And here you can find more about our up and coming guest and links to all kinds of information about them, our Twitter and Facebook pages, and also a link to our podcast. So if you miss an episode or want to listen to an episode again or listen to all of our episodes, you can find that and listen to them.
Inspiration Dissemination is recorded live, and should they occur, any opinions expressed on the show are those of the hosts and their guests and do not necessarily represent Oregon State University or this station. Tonight, we are joined by Alan Harrington, who is a second-year master's student in the Department of Animal and Rangeland Sciences, who's working with Dr. Jonathan Dinkins. Alan's research and fieldwork focuses on three species of sage-grouse steppe habitat obligate songbirds. Hi, Alan. Welcome.
How y'all doing?
Good.
Good. How are you?
I'm good. That intro just got me super inspired. I felt like there was a lot of dissemination of information that's about to happen.
Oh, so. Yes.
It is. Specifically about songbirds, I would guess.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Hopefully. Hopefully not going to throw a curveball at us and start talking about something we're not prepared for. In talking to you before the show, it became very clear to Heather and myself that I guess the topic that surrounds your research question is quite complex. Like, there's a lot of different layers to it. So I think the best way to maybe start off is, how about you tell us first a little bit about sagebrush steppe habitat? A mouthful.
Sure. Yeah. So sagebrush steppe habitat, also known as just sagebrush ecosystem or sagebrush. It encompasses a lot of the Western United States. It's sort of flagship, sort of the reason why it is called sagebrush steppe is because of the sagebrush, which is a species, and it's sort of subspecies that occupy and kind of make up this ecosystem. So there's multiple different subspecies of sagebrush, and they kind of occur in their own complexities across the landscape. But sagebrush basically makes up and forms the sagebrush steppe ecosystem.
So something that I was a little confused about when we first talked about this is, but it's also really interesting, is that the sagebrush habitat is really defined by the plant that is there. And it, like, the type of ecosystem that you would picture in your mind is very diverse for this. So it goes, like, up onto mountains and also down into lower elevation. It's pretty much anywhere that's flat, it seems like, with this plant.
Yeah. Well, I think, like, people oftentimes think of it as kind of being an ecotype that is in flatter areas. But I mean, especially in my study area in Eastern Oregon, I've come to find that just when you think that it's going to be an ecosystem in sort of the flatter parts of Western North America, you'll go out into these canyon lands in some of these areas in Eastern Oregon, you're like, Nope, it's definitely not in some of these flat places, because this area is crazy as far as its topography. But you're right, and there's also a lot of places, especially sort of the transitional zone in Wyoming, where the grasslands are sort of forming more into shrublands, and that area is definitely very flat. So I would say that if anything, it's very diverse in sort of the topography in which it where it can occur on the landscape.
So sagebrush, very widespread in Western North America, and it's super important for a lot of different species, especially birds. So how about you talk us a little bit about the background of like the main species that's often connected to sagebrush, which is the greater sage grouse.
Sure. Yeah. So greater sage grouse, they're a galliform. So there are a species that, is in fact hunted in the United States, and they have a lot of close cousins that are also of other grouse species. Some that are even in similar habitats, like the sharp-tailed grouse. But probably what's most important about this species is just how much research and political scrutiny it gets based on where it occurs in Western North America, and the fact that it is a representative species of the sagebrush habitat. And so, it's kind of like something that a lot of people have heard the name of and know about, but they don't necessarily know maybe where it occurs or, kind of why it's such a important species that they may hear in headlines or something like that, that are talking about environmental conservation in Western United States. So the sage grouse is considered a sagebrush obligate species. Mm-hmm. And so it requires sagebrush to fulfill all of its biological needs. And it has received a lot of that political and, there's a lot of eyes on this species because of both where it occurs and how important it is to represent the ecosystem that it remains in, and sort of the kind of current political and environmental climate that exists around sagebrush habitats.
Right. And so because it's hunted, right, so there's, interest, for the population to continue to do well, and so that, can continue to be hunted. And also because it is an obligate of sagebrush, it is linked quite closely to the habitat. What does that mean for the conservation of that habitat?
Sure. Yeah. So, before we dive into all of this terminology, so I think what you're getting at here is the fact that, my research really focuses around the fact that this species in particular, the sage grouse, is considered an umbrella species for this habitat.
Yes, that is what I was getting at.
And, what that means is that the sage grouse, is sort of a representative species in this ecosystem. And therefore, this idea of surrogate species conservation, the umbrella species concept, a lot of these ecological terms that are thrown around really just mean that this species is thought to represent this ecosystem. And by protecting this species, you're creating an umbrella of conservation that exists across the entire sagebrush steppe habitat. And therefore, you're protecting any other sagebrush associated or sagebrush obligate species that occur within that same habitat.
Why is it a bird in particular that would be this umbrella species or an indicator species? I know it's otherwise sometimes called, as opposed to maybe some kind of rodent or, I don't know, a hardier animal.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. There's a couple answers to that, but I think probably the most significant ones would be the fact that, like I said, it is an obligate species, and so it is extremely closely tied to the ecosystem that it occurs in. I mean, sage grouse not only spend the wonderful parts of the year, the spring and the summertime, in sagebrush habitat, where they're breeding and they're sort of just enjoying the fruits of that time of year, but they also have to overwinter in that habitat mm-hmm. as well. And so, so they're not only very closely tied to that habitat during these really formidable seasons of the year, where they're you know breeding and hopefully keeping their population numbers where they need to be, but they are also reliant upon that habitat in the wintertime, which is very different than the three sagebrush obligate species that I study. But the other thing that kind of makes this bird species in particular, and many other bird species across ecosystems and taxa, sort of umbrella species for that ecosystem, is the fact that they typically respond very quickly to any sort of environmental change. Mm-hmm. That's sort of just one of the benefits as researchers that we have in studying birds, is that they can oftentimes be one of the best indicators of ecosystem health and any changes that are occurring in those habitats and in those ecosystems. So,
so before we dive into what is kind of the current state, I guess, of that habitat and of the sage grouse, let's talk a little bit about your bird species, because it's not directly the sage grouse. It is songbirds, or three species of songbird. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the three?
Yeah, for sure. So, my research is kind of focusing around this idea of conservation by proxy, which is another term and jargon that I'm not going to dive too far into. But the idea really is that by studying one species, we're going to obtain information about an ecosystem as a whole. It can also often be employed with greater sage grouse, but my interests really are focused around these three species, and whether or not these other three sagebrush obligate species are also receiving these same conservation protections that are employed in sagebrush habitats and in that landscape for greater sage grouse. So those three species include the brewer's sparrow, the sagebrush sparrow, and the sage thrasher. And all three of those are migratory species that require sagebrush in order to complete the breeding needs that they have in spring and into summer.
And so we wanted you to bring some sounds, some songs of those birds, but you forgot to. So sing for us, Alan. I'm kidding. I'm not going to make you do that. But so basically what you're trying to get at is you're putting this umbrella species concept to the test, right? To see whether the conservation of the sage grouse has created this umbrella for not only the sagebrush steppe habitat, but for these other sagebrush obligate birds that require the habitat for their life history.
Yeah, definitely. So, the umbrella species concept isn't just unique to sagebrush habitats. It's a single species approach to conservation that's actually very widely applied across taxa and ecosystems. And so really I'm just trying to poke some more holes in this umbrella species concept, where you know, it is this very widely and accepted theoretical approach to or even you could consider it a shortcut to conservation and the application of it. Yet it's very rarely empirically tested. And so, the benefits of my research are extending beyond just bringing some more applied information for managers and people who have interests in, you know, how species are doing and responding in this environment, but also hopefully will answer some more broader questions about the theory of umbrella species conservation and sort of, you know, of course, my goal is to kind of figure out if it truly is providing well for these other three sage obligate species, or if maybe there's some gaps in knowledge there that I can fill with this research.
So what is the current state maybe within Oregon or wider, if you want to talk more about that? But there's a lot of political talk involved. There's a lot of concerns and information that is maybe important for the background of understanding why this research is really important.
Yeah, well, so I'm unfortunately this ecosystem, so the sagebrush steppe habitat, is one of the most imperiled ecosystems in North America. Along with grasslands, it is declining at a faster rate than any other ecosystem, and so the effects of that, you know, are sort of, you could think of them as a trickle down effect, in that the depletion of the habitat itself is going to have implications for the critters that are occupying that habitat. And what we have seen really since European settlement is that sage-grouse populations and other sage-associated species have also been in decline along with the habitat. So that also paired with the fact that the greater sage-grouse, like we've mentioned, that's sort of representative of this ecosystem, has been petitioned for listing under the Endangered Species Act on more than one occasion, both in 2010 and 2015. And that listing was warranted, but ended up being precluded. So they weren't actually listed as an endangered species. But what the repercussions of that really were, sort of the intensity of stakeholders and their involvement in this issue, and really kind of pushing both managers, researchers, private landowners, etc., to all want to get their hands and their investments in this conservation effort to do whatever was necessary to kind of keep these birds from listing. And so there have been a lot of grassroots efforts and organizations that have been working really hard over the past, 5-10 years to both produce a bunch of research and also implement on the ground conservation and protection of these species.
Yeah, so you mentioned stakeholders and private landowners, and I think something that we haven't mentioned yet is the fact that sagebrush steppe habitat often doubles as land used for grazing cattle, or is often like very adjacent to farmland. And so that's kind of like this conflict, well, not really conflict, but I guess this problem that's arising, or what people are concerned about, is that if this greater sage grouse is listed, then there will be greater restrictions on how that land can be used. Is that kind of the idea for like this worry or concern?
Yeah, definitely. So the Endangered Species Act is a federal process that if critters do end up getting listed, that can have implications for any habitat that's designated as critical for those species. So the risk that's involved for all of these stakeholders, cattle ranching, agriculture, oil and gas, a lot of these sort of land uses also happen to parallel with sagebrush habitats, and the repercussions could be pretty catastrophic for a lot of industry, a lot of economic value for both states in the American West if these birds were listed. So when I say stakeholders, I'm really referring to not only the people that manage the public lands that these birds occupy, all sagebrush obligates, but also the industry and the economic value that can come from sagebrush rangelands.
So let's get into your actual role in this research and study. So you go out into the field and you do other research. Can you tell us, like, what does your day-to-day research look like and what are you doing at OSU?
Yeah. So I have this really kind of, I mean, for me, it's a very unique opportunity. I've spent quite a lot of time in my professional career in and around university settings. And this is the first time that I've ever worked on a project that's so incredibly collaborative. So I work with two other lab mates in my department that also collect data in the exact same study area that we all work within. One of those is collecting data on raven ecology, and the other student in my lab is collecting all of this greater sage grouse data as well. So we have a very collaborative project, which makes our day-to-day operations interesting, to say the least. If anything, it's a data research season that, you know, you think you have an idea of what's going on that week, and it could be completely different just based on the rigor of the work and the dynamics of the work. But I like to tell people that the typical field day that we have out there is, you know, getting up really early in the morning, well before the sun comes up, to drive to these locations that we do all of the surveying that we do for each one of our given projects. My research in particular, I'm collecting abundance data on the three sagebrush obligate songbirds that I'm interested in. And then I'm also collecting nesting data on them as well. So we have a study area of 1.4 million acres across eastern Oregon. It covers five different priority areas of conservation for greater sage grouse. Those are areas that were designated by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And they're supposed to encompass. I don't know where I'm coming up with these words this evening.
It's Sunday. It's been a long week.
I mean, I swear they're just two words that are pieced together. Like, they do stem from two different words. it encompasses habitat that has the highest density of breeding sage grouse in the state. So we cover five of those priority areas of conservation. And we sample for abundance of raptors, ravens, and then of course my songbirds at 147 random point locations that are buffered about 2,500 meters apart from each other. And then in addition to those 147 points that we sample at, I'm collecting information on nests that I find, doing nest transects to and from those locations, as well as the plethora of sage grouse locations that we get from my other lab mate who's collecting data on greater sage grouse. She'll provide me with a wealth of GPS locations for all of those greater sage grouse, and I also do abundance surveys and nest searching surveys to and from grouse locations as well.
I think you're definitely right by saying that how you conduct your fieldwork is super unique. I haven't heard of many or any people who like get to work so closely with all of their lab mates, usually because projects are so, I guess, different and diverse. And so I think that is a cool thing, that because you're all working in the sagebrush steppe habitat, you do get to work together and, like, you know, plow through difficult situations together. I know you told us that you guys get to drive ATVs around. Yeah. I bet you there's been, you know, maybe some problems or accidents with those.
Man, you really have a unique way of making it all sound like so lighthearted. No, it really is it's a fantastic opportunity. I have never, like I said, never worked on such a highly collaborative project before. So, but you're right. It poses a lot of challenges at the same time. You know, we have to navigate what really seems like almost the most impossible logistics that could ever be, you know, that you could ever be presented with. But it does provide a lot of unique opportunity for collaboration in data, collaboration in, you know, the unique individuals that we work with out there. We work with all kinds of biologists on from, you know, the state agencies, federal agencies, tribal agencies. We're working with the sheriff's department. I mean, it's a huge, massive operation, but at the end of the day, it is very rewarding and a really cool, unique opportunity to be able to share that with two other graduate students that are also, you know, in the same landscape collecting data. Real time, right, at the same time. So.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to make it sound so rosy. I do field work too, so I know how hard it is. Especially because I think so. You told us before this interview that you guys have like three kind of home bases in Eastern Oregon that you kind of move between because you obviously have, you know, your locations are across 1.4 million acres of land, so you obviously need to kind of, you know, switch where you live. And I think you said one of them are these camper trailers that have like very limited amenities.
Yeah, so this is straight up a shout out to Lindsay in my lab right now because she had to endure an entire season at this location this past field season, whereas previous ones we've been in more of a rotation. We'll be rotating again this upcoming summer, but yeah, so we work across this huge landscape, and we have three sort of hubs that we work out of in order to be able to meet all of the data needs that we have. But what that ends up meaning is that two of our locations are quite plush in the amenities that we get as we're out in the field. You know, a legit like living area where you can cook and clean and do laundry and all that sort of stuff. But there is sort of that.
This
is, right.
I'm kidding.
Okay, maybe not flat screen, but the like 90s TVs have got like the round front to them.
Oh, nice.
Yeah,
nice.
Like
retro.
The pixels are like, yeah, that is an option. It's a potential. The middle site that you're talking about is definitely our most remote location. It's outside of Gentura, Oregon, which if you've heard of Gentura, Oregon, then I feel like you're quite well traveled in the state of Oregon.
I'm clearly not well traveled.
Yeah, I have no idea.
It's right off of Highway 20 in between Burns and Ontario, Oregon. It's a small little cow town there. And we stay at a BLM campground called Chucker Park, where we have two different, you know, camper trailers out there that have really, I mean, one of them in particular, but both of them have been through some stuff. And they, you know, they have limited amenities, of course, at this campground. There's running water, but it's not turned on till 2 months after we get there. And, you know, there's showering facilities are limited. And so we really make sure that we put a research crew out there that is
hardy
and capable of enduring the elements.
How long is this season that you're out there?
Well, so my lab mates, their work starts a little bit earlier than mine and goes a little bit later. But my research in particular starts at the beginning of May and it wraps up about mid-July. And that's all based around the sort of the beginning and the tail ends of the breeding season for these migratory songbirds.
But since you guys are so collaborative, you leave earlier, right, to like help your lab mates with their data collection.
Yeah, so actually I get out there about the third week of March, and depending on my morale towards mid-July, try to stay at least till the beginning of August.
That's a lot of like school time to be missing. I couldn't imagine a field season that goes so long.
Yeah, so I actually miss all of spring term. Yeah. And you know what? Thus far, it hasn't been too challenging to navigate. If anything, it's kind of, you know, I just pack in those other two terms. But yeah, I mean, it becomes a struggle and a challenge when I'm thinking about, you know, well, I would really like to take this class, but it's only offered in spring term. Mm-hmm. So that's the one time that it's like
bummer.
A bit of a bummer. Yeah exactly.
So I guess speaking of school, let's transition a little and talk about how Alan came to be here at OSU, your journey to sagebrush obligate songbird ecology.
Oh, Lordy.
I guess we can start, I guess kind of high school is when it kind of became clear to you that maybe science in general was something you wanted to pursue, right?
Yeah.
Like wildlife biology.
Like maybe a lot of high schoolers, I was sort of just like, meh, I can't wait to get out of here kind of attitude. But towards the end of my high school career, I actually had this super unique opportunity to do an internship with the district wildlife manager in the county that I grew up in. And it was definitely a sort of formidable time as far as, you know, thinking about my future pursuits, both in my undergraduate program at Colorado State, but just sort of kind of an eye opener as far as like, this could be something that you could do someday, like, and get paid. And yeah, it was a really awesome opportunity. I mean, I did everything from going out with the district wildlife manager and, you know, helping her out with a greater sage grouse survey, which I feel like I'm coming full circle here, but,
yeah.
and we, you know, translocated a small population of sharp-tailed grouse, and I would help her with like wildlife human conflict mitigation and just all these other things that, you know, I just didn't really realize the ins and outs of a job quite like that. So it really kind of set me up well for once I started to think about, you know, the schools that I potentially want to go to and the undergraduate biological programs that they would have. That experience definitely helped me kind of navigate that next step.
And I, something that made me really laugh during our pre-interview was that when you were talking about this like volunteer internship experience in high school, you said that you kind of got to see like the best parts of the job, and you were like, well, of course they're not going to make high school students do boring paperwork, and you were like totally hooked just by like all the fun stuff you got to do outside. So it is kind of funny. They were maybe like trying to lure like the next generation of wildlife biologists with you.
Yeah, I still to this day don't know if that was her goal or if, you know, she just was a nice enough person to be like, yeah, I'm not going to make him sit here and watch me, you know, put these signatures down on paper and check these boxes. But yeah, I looking back now, I'm like, holy cow, did I sort of get the VIP experience.
And you kind of after you made that decision and you did your undergrad at your home state at Colorado State University. And, you know, after that, you still kind of knew that you wanted to continue down this path of wildlife biology. You did like a lot of jobs, like all over the country. I think you went to Texas, Wisconsin. And then I think kind of the place that became most maybe formative for you to make the decision to go on to grad school was at the University of Montana. Do you want to talk about your time there at the Avian Science Center?
Yeah, sure. So I actually first got to Montana with a research position with Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. I feel like you guys are just highlighting my my greater sage grouse professional activities.
Sorry.
Which, you know, it's fitting. The first time I got to Montana was for a position with Fish, Wildlife, and Parks as a greater sage grouse a research technician, but that ended up spiraling into my position at the University of Montana, working at the Avian Science Center there. And that project was interested in looking at the response of songbirds to different grazing regimes in central Montana. It was, yeah, incredibly formidable for me as an aspiring field biologist. You know, not only had I started to get the opportunities to lead research, implement pretty large scale research in central Montana and leading these research crews to get that data collected. But once the research seasons were over, I would come back to the university and be working in the Avian Science Center to help, you know, work through reporting of that data and the development of publications, as well as, you know, what ended up being sort of towards the end of my time there, working on some really novel research, looking at survey methodology, and so that's kind of how I wrapped up that position there. But it definitely was the game changer as far as getting me from, you know, I hate this phrase, but the data robot of being a field biologist, and then kind of opening that up for broader avenues of really what the profession's like and kind of what that next step looked like.
And that project that you just talked about survey methodology was just published. Congratulations, right?
Yeah. Thank you. This was a project that...
that you like had a very big hand in.
Yeah.
Kind of
so
building. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So Caitlin Strickenfold, she's a newly graduated undergraduate from the University of Montana program, and a lot of credit to her for how much blood, sweat, and tears she put into the sort of production of this publication. But a lot of the sort of latter half of the 6 months that I spent at the end of my time there at the University of Montana was developing this research and getting it up to the data collection stage. So we're super excited to report that just got published in Yay. Ecological Applications. And that's basically the papers outlining sort of the benefits of a double dependent observer survey process and how well that assists in reducing issues like misidentification and the double counting of critters on the landscape when you're doing abundance surveys. So yeah, that was a nice big feat of 2019. So
yeah, that's awesome. We're slowly coming to the end of our time, but before we move on to our two traditions on the show, I just really quickly want to touch upon kind of the an experience that you had starting graduate school, actually at a different school, because I think this is sometimes something that isn't often talked about when you kind of have problems in your department or with your advisor and kind of the options that you have to not be tied there. So do you quickly want to give us a little bit of a rundown of that and how you feel about it now that you're here?
Sure. Yeah, so I guess this is, you know, sort of my take for any of those listeners that are thinking about going to graduate school and the approach that I would advise them to take. So Oregon State University wasn't the first time that I got accepted to a graduate program. I actually was accepted to another graduate program in California. And I guess if we're transitioning more into this phase where we're talking about the sort of formidable time of your professional life, it is a good, important thing to talk about, just because I think a lot of people hear about these horror stories of going to graduate school and kind of what that can entail based on, it being a big jump for professional people or people wanting to pursue that advanced degree, and the things you might expect to happen that may not end up happening for you. But Yeah, so I had gotten into a program in California, and you know, it'd been something I'd been working on for a long time. It really was research that I was excited about, and I ended up, you know, leaving my position in Montana and moving down to California for it, and ultimately ended up being a project that. The research was really interesting, and I think it could be the right experience, but the support just wasn't there. And, you know, I think that if anything, it's just really important for people who are interested in pursuing an advanced degree in science, especially when there's something like intense field rigor that revolves around it, to really make sure that departments and programs that are supporting that kind of research really have the foundation and the robust output to be able to follow along, or follow through for their students rather. And unfortunately this experience just was not that the case for me. So I ended up, after my pilot season, not actually ever starting that program, which I'm really thankful for, because if anything, it got me to where I'm at now, which I have nothing but wonderful things to say about being a graduate student here at this institution. But I also think that it speaks to the fact that, you know, it really is important for people in pursuing their advanced degrees to know that they're going into an institution that's going to support them, that there's more than just the research there for them. There's more than just a really nice and easygoing rapport with them and a faculty member at that institution, and that really there's so much more to your graduate experience beyond the research and beyond that one interpersonal connection that you have with an advisor. So so being here, I have an incredible advisor here. I'm super lucky. He's very supportive of all the work that goes on and works effortlessly, not yes, effort.
That's yeah, a
effortlessly.
Word.
Yeah. It seemed weird in the moment because I was like, "Well, it's not effortless."
He works effortlessly.
He works tirelessly. We'll put it that way. Make sure.
Actually, and ensure. I don't think effortlessly makes sense. Tirelessly, right,
exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Tirelessly to make sure that his students are having a positive experience, and that's just not the case everywhere you go. Sometimes, you know. Even at this level of education, somebody's not going to work for their students. So, it was a very, it formed a lot about how I lead and guide myself as a professional now, but probably most importantly, it makes me really grateful for the place that I'm at now and kind of not take for granted any of the experiences, like being here, for example,
yeah.
Oregon State, and talking about this really cool research that we're doing at in the Dinkins Lab.
That's awesome. Thanks for sharing that. We have had a few people on the show talk about that. I think Oregon State is a really welcoming environment, maybe friendlier than everywhere, maybe not everywhere else, but I like it too.
Me too. Me three.
Yes. I wanted to say also that if you want to find links to Alan's lab's Twitter or to his most recent publication and see pictures of the birds, etc., it's all on the blog at blogs.oregonstate.edu/inspiration. And it's the most recent blog titled Putting Years and Years of Established Theory to the Test.
Ooh.
Dun,
now,
dun, dun.
Now go forth and do it, Alan.
Yes. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's been a real pleasure having you.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah. We have a couple traditions on Inspiration Dissemination. Number one is to offer up a piece of advice that you would like to give someone on a similar journey or a past self or anyone listening at home.
Yeah, I think probably the advice I would give myself, which of course I think is the best advice to give anyone listening.
Yourself, like in the past? Past
in the
Alan?
Past self. Okay. Is really just to believe in the things that you you know, that you feel most passionate about, and to effortlessly, just kidding.
Tirelessly.
Keep working. Keep
working. I'm here for you, Alan.
keep working towards that, because in the end, you know, things are going to work out. You just have to keep pushing through barriers or navigating them however you need. Sometimes you don't push. Sometimes you just go around.
Step around. Step around to a new school. To a new state.
See, I knew I'd have you guys on my team.
Okay. Yes, and our our second tradition is that you pick the song that ends your interview. So, is there anything you want to say about the song before you play it? Do you want to introduce it?
Yeah, one quick thing. So, I study birds.
What?
Or, you know, shocker. And although I wouldn't necessarily consider myself an avid birder, I do love birds, and there happens to be a lot of other bird loving people in my family. And real quick, my mom's grandmother's maiden name was Ferguson, and mm-hmm. a lot of these bird enthusiasts in my family, we now have a group chat called Ferg's Birds.
Oh.
Pretty sure they're gonna love this song.
Okay, so it's for your family.
It's for the fam.
Do you want me to say the title, or should I just play it? Should it be a little surprise?
I think you can say the title.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, again, Alan, thanks so much for joining us on the show, and everyone listening. You are now going to listen to Surfin' Bird by The Trashmen. Enjoy.
Thank you for listening. If you want to support the show, tell your friends about it and give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, and follow us on Twitter and Facebook at KBVRID.
This theme music was performed by the OSU Drumline, and the intro jingle was created by Olin Haman. Special thanks to the supporting staff at KBVR that allow the show and podcast to be possible.
This show was started by Jean Kamvar and Joey Hulbert in 2012. To learn about our current hosts, other graduate students at Oregon State, or if you want to be part of the show, visit our website at blogs.oregonstate.edu/inspiration. Thanks again for listening, and stay curious, my friends.